You are listening to Podcasters of Horror, a podcast about exploring horror anthologies from film and TV, as part of the Super Network, with your hosts, Super Marcy.
And he just gave off, like, very creepy vibes, so you're always very unsure of this guy.
And the terrible Australian, Beat Germine.
Which, in that version, it's a Krusty the Clown doll that's harassing Homer.
This podcast may contain coarse language.
It just kept getting weirder and weirder, and it's, what the f*** is up with this house?
Adult themes.
You know, she's only just a little girl, but he really is very mean to her.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. For more information, please visit supermarcy.com or see the show notes. To show your support, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Please enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Podcasters of Horror, the podcast that is about horror anthologies from TV and film. I am your host, Super Marcy, and this is episode 30, which is a big milestone for the show, which means we are going back into the Twilight Zone.
You're traveling through another dimension, a dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. Your next stop, the Twilight Zone.
And joining me in the Twilight Zone is my regular co-host. He is the terrible Australian, Bede Germine. Hello, Bede. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks, Marcy. How are you?
Doing all right. Just freezing everything in this horrible Melbourne. I was going to say winter, but we're technically not in winter. It's still autumn.
Yeah, I know. And also...
might as well be winter.
And also, while I was at work, Marcy, today it was raining down as well. So I wasn't happy about that. So luckily it's
miserable.
Exactly. And that seems to happen a lot when it gets to this time of the year for Melbourne. I am blaming it on the Twilight Zone, if I have to say so myself.
Yes, it is like we're living in the Twilight Zone. And joining us is a first-time guest of Podcasters of Horror, but a returning guest to the Super Network, and that is our good friend and co-host of Imprint Cast, Tony Mikus. Hello, Tony, and thank you for joining us.
Hello, Marcy and Bede. Believe me, it's an absolute pleasure to be involved in this episode. Thank you for the invite. Of course, anything horror-related, I'm more than happy to talk about.
And of course, it is the Twilight Zone, and how could you resist?
Indeed.
So thank you for joining us. This should be an interesting episode. So basically what I did or have done with the Twilight Zone episodes is I have listed a bunch of, I guess, hand-selected Twilight Zone episodes. And whenever we do an episode, that is the list to choose from, because there are a hell of a lot of episodes of the show. So it is an easier way to narrow that down. So for this episode, we each picked a Twilight Zone episode, and those are The After Hours, which was my pick, The Dummy, which was Tony's pick, and An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, which was Bede's pick. So if you're both ready, let's get to the first episode of discussion, which is The After Hours.
I'm not accustomed to such service.
Ma'am?
Well, there were a whole lot of people waiting for the elevator. I seem to have a private one.
Well, this is an express elevator, ma'am. To the 9th floor.
And it is from season 1, episode 34. It was written by Rod Serling and directed by Douglas Hayes. It stars Anne Francis, Elizabeth Allen, James Milholland, John Conwell, Patrick White, and Nancy Renick. The synopsis: a woman is treated badly by some odd salespeople on an otherwise empty department floor store. This episode shares some similarities to Mannequin. Whether or not it was directly inspired, I don't know. And that alone kind of may spoil a bit of the episode for you. And our opening narration. Express elevator to the ninth floor of a department store, carrying Miss Marsha White on a most prosaic, ordinary run-of-the-mill errand. Miss Marsha White on the ninth floor, specialties department, looking for a gold thimble. The odds are that she'll find it, but there are even better odds that she'll find something else, because this isn't just a regular department store. This happens to be the Twilight Zone. Now, I'm no Rod Serling, so my opening and closing narrations are done to the best of my ability. As this was my pick, I'll go first on just my basic thoughts on the episode. So, yeah, Bede and I watched this one together, and yes, we probably did make a few jokes and a few Mannequin references, which is very understandable. And I think even without knowing what, you know, sort of has similarities to, you kind of know where it's going. But I think that it's the delivery of it all is what makes it interesting. We see Marsha, played by Anne Francis, in the department store, and it does feel very random that she's after a gold thimble, which is never explained. She just says it's a present for her mother, and she goes up to the ninth floor and it's basically empty, but then a woman shows up and sells her a gold thimble, which is the only thing in the little showcase window. But it gets a bit weirder because the sales lady knows her name and things just seem to be very weird for her. And then she kind of, towards the end, comes to the realization that she's not actually a person, but a mannequin. And the ending kind of implies that she somehow became a person mannequin, because it seems like the manager of the department store recognizes her mannequin, because he would have just seen her the previous day. It's a little bit hokey, but I quite enjoyed it overall as an episode. Tony, what did you think of The After Hours?
The After Hours, I gotta say, that was actually a fun episode. Of course, I love Anne Francis, especially from Forbidden Planet. But then, with the story of this woman who's on a mission to look for a gold thimble, which I agree with you, Marcy, it's a very odd choice of a gift to get for your mother for her birth. I don't know if it's for her birthday or for Mother's Day, but I forgot what it was. But yeah, it was a very odd choice to pick that, but. But the setup of the episode is really fascinating, because if you look carefully, going up to the ninth floor, which is what they call the stock floor, the sales department floor, I believe, and you don't see the number nine on the elevator. You only see 8, 1 to 8, and then you see the R.
Yeah.
At the end, and then the arrow goes over the R, and then you realize, okay, something's not right. Mm. But it's even creepier when no one's there except Suzette. Was it Suzanne Allen?
Elizabeth Allen plays the saleswoman.
Elizabeth Allen as a saleswoman. Yeah, I thought she was very pretty. But then after the sales transaction ended and then you see a mannequin, I thought, okay, so what is going on up on that floor? But then you realize afterwards that it's not just her. It's literally the whole department, the whole store is, spoilers alert, by the way, just letting you know.
Yes.
But the ending I thought was quite good. I quite liked it, especially, I didn't expect Anne Francis to be one herself. And that really, because she was a day late, apparently, because apparently every mannequin in the store gets to live as a human for a month. And they just enjoy it. But she was one day late. And it seemed like there was going to be some kind of punishment, but there wasn't, which is a little bit of a anticlimactic sequence, but still.
Yeah. It's weird because it sort of, you're not really sure if it's that. I mean, it makes sense if you go live as a human for a month.
Yeah.
I don't know if I quite like got that or what was going on, but I did. Mm. I did like the vision of the Anne Francis mannequin at the end. Yes. And then the kind of almost breaking the fourth wall from the like manager at the end, I thought was quite good. But yes, it's quite an enjoyable episode. But I kind of thought that the thimble would maybe be what her mannequin was going to be displaying, but it never really comes back.
No, it doesn't come back.
Not too sure. Bede, what did you think of this one?
Actually, this is my second time seeing the episode because this was actually one of the first Twilights I saw when I was younger. Because I remember when I was down at my local video shop, and you remember back in those days, Marcy, whenever they had a TV show, they would never put the whole series on.
No. Any,
they picked select episodes as a compilation. And this one was on a compilation of episodes that I watched, and the other two, one that we have done for this very show, which of course is The Monsters Are on Maple Street. And also the other episode being Time Enough at Last with Burgess Meredith. Those were the first three Twilight Zone episodes I ever saw. So I was already very aware of this episode. And I was looking forward to revisiting this one for the show. And I still reckon it's a really fun episode, although it's not a great episode. I think what makes it memorable is the twist when you find out that she is actually a mannequin. And for me, that is the most memorable aspect of the film. And I think when people think of the Twilight Zone, in terms of the many twists and turns that the show delivers with all of its episodes, I think this is definitely up there as one of the more well-known ones in terms of its twist ending, when you find out that, oh, this woman was a mannequin the entire time. But when I rewatched it with you the other day, Marcy, I think even though I was enjoying the episode, I was poking at it a lot because I'm thinking to myself, there's a lot of plot holes and logic gaps in this episode, and things just don't really make sense when you sit down and dissect the episode from beginning to end. Like, the idea is still a pretty good one, and it is a fun episode because of that. But when you kind of think about it, there are so many questions that this episode never really addresses. Like, so for example, we know that the character of Marcia is a mannequin. And one of the things that this apartment store, as like you said before, Tony, is that every month, one of the mannequins gets to go out and live their life as a human for 1 month and then they come back.
Yeah.
But then when I sort of really thought about it, I'm thinking, why does it have to be one? Why can't all of them just go? And also, when you kind of think about it, the reason Marcia doesn't realize that she is a mannequin is because she was at least a day or two late from getting back. So I'm thinking to myself, like, so throughout that entire month, do you actually remember everything that of your life as a mannequin? And then if you go over the dates, you start to lose your memories as a mannequin. And also, who is her mother? Who is she buying this gold thimble for? Like, when you kind of think about it, a lot of the episode doesn't really make sense. Like, it is a good idea. And I think Rod Serling, on a writing level, still makes it a fun episode. And also, the performances are all really good in this one. But I think the episode, what stops it for me from being a truly great one is, yeah, some aspects of the plot don't really make a lot of sense when you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, because you can only do so much with 25 minutes, there isn't a lot of time to explain things more. Like, is it that they get put out as a special display for the month? And if they're not put back in time, then they turn human for some reason with a whole backstory of memories. I'm not sure. Like, it could be a number of things. Like, maybe each mannequin has a life and backstory and memories or something. Like, it's not really explained, but again, it is a Twilight Zone department store, so maybe anything is possible.
Well, that is true. And even thinking about it now, like, what is the thy floor? Like, it's not on the actual elevator. Is it a supernatural realm where all these mannequins just go to afterwards? Like, again, you're right. This is like a 20-odd minute episode. There's not enough time to kind of explain everything. And I kind of have a feeling, though, and I'm just speculating about this, is I feel like Rob Serling thought up the twist first and then tried to build a story around it.
I mean, that could be possible.
That makes sense, actually.
Yeah.
Because that would make sense in terms of, like, why the episode, at least for me, has so many sort of plot holes and logic gaps. It's like, oh, I got this cool idea for a twist ending. I just need to build a story around it. What can I do instead of... And, you know, and that tends to happen sometimes. Like, I think there have been a lot of well-known films that have actually started off with the idea of the twist and then retroactively kind of went backwards to kind of fill in the gaps. But I feel like with this one, though, I feel like if the episode had a lot more time, maybe it probably some aspects of the plot would have been more developed. But I think what's interesting, though, is... Now, on a few episodes back, Marcy, we talked about the 80s version of The Twilight Zone. And The After Hours is actually one of the episodes from the original series that was actually remade for the 80s incarnation. So I'm kind of interested to watch that take on the episode and see how different it is, or if it's kind of just more similar, or do they kind of fix up some of the problems that I had.
Yeah, because I haven't seen it, or at least I don't remember. So we may have to do that on a future episode where we cover some episodes from the 80s version of The Twilight Zone. But, you know, also I think it can work as being very ambiguous because we are literally sitting here talking about what it could be, what if it's plot holes or whatever. So in a way, I think that kind of works. But, yeah, I think the strongest aspects of this one for me are the performances of Anne Francis and Elizabeth Allen. I think they're the two strongest ones, and it's definitely worth watching for them. And in regards to the ninth floor, I think it is meant to be like the storeroom stock area where all the stuff they're not using gets put. So I'm guessing, or maybe that's it. Maybe the mannequins get changed up once a month from there to be on the floor, I suppose, like thinking about it now, because they're all kind of in there. But I guess the other thing that doesn't make sense is one of the mannequins being the elevator guy. That isn't explained, and I don't understand. Was he there to help her get back and remember it? Again, that's another one that is very ambiguous. So what do you both think that could be, Tony?
I'm thinking about it now. Like, as you said, with the level 9 being the storeroom, you may have a point, because if you've ever worked in retail and you see all these, you see like hundreds of mannequins, but mind you, they're naked and limbless most of the time. and they're just basically put out just to wait until next month's sale or whatever. But it actually does, that actually is a good point, but of course, being the episode released in 1962, it wouldn't be, or 1960 or 1959, I don't remember.
I don't think, actually.
1960,
there we go.
1960, okay. I don't think, even though you don't see any nipple action or anything else, a naked, limbless mannequin in the storeroom would be pleasant. So I guess they have to dress it up somehow. but with the guy with the elevator man, I don't know. I agree with you, Marcy. That is a little bit of an odd one, I better say. But well, then I think it must be a mannequin also, because his face had some kind of smooth plastic complexion. That's how I saw it. Mind you, I saw it on Blu-ray. It actually has a bit of HD stuff. So that's how I saw it. But I think that was it mainly. Mm-hmm. I think the elevator guy was a mannequin himself as well.
and sort of trying to help her get back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bede, what are your thoughts on those things?
Well, now that I think about it, the elevator which takes Marsha up to floor 9, when she steps into the elevator, she says, oh, this is weird. It's like, oh, there's so many people out there and I have this elevator all to myself. So I guess in a way it could be seen as this is a supernatural elevator that she only notices. So there's definitely some...
I'm just thinking about it. Maybe that's the specific elevator for moving stock and not for the people to use.
Maybe.
That's actually a good point.
Yeah.
Because did you see how other people were waiting onto the elevator, but no one was in the next elevator? So that could be the stock elevator. That's actually a good point.
Yeah, because I was just thinking that as well. So that could be something. So, we're just uncovering it all. We're working out the plot holes.
But I will say, though, I think what makes the episode for me are the performances. I think Anne Francis is great as Marsha, but I did love Elizabeth Allard as that saleswoman that she does meet when she gets to the ninth floor. And also enjoyed James Milholland as Mr. Armbruster. What a weird last name. He made me laugh quite a lot throughout this episode with his performance.
Definitely. There's always some good standouts in each episode, which I really like.
Definitely, definitely.
We'll get to rating out of 5 and final thoughts. And my rating for this is 3.5. I kind of hope I'm not a mannequin out of 5. I did quite enjoy the episode. I don't think it's as good as some others that we've covered on the show, but it's still like very enjoyable and very watchable and definitely recommended. So yeah, I liked it. And I'm glad I picked it because it was a good one to kind of dissect there a little bit. Tony.
Yeah, it was a good introduction to this episode in particular. And I agree with you, Marcy. I'm also giving it 3.5 out of 5.
Awesome. And Bede.
I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 5 as well, even though I do have problems with it due to the plot holes that we had discussed throughout it. But I still think it is a fun episode, and it is a memorable one. So you can definitely see why this episode, out of all the episodes from the original incarnation of the show, why this one is as memorable as it is. But I do think at the same time, though, I think it's more to do with the actual twist more than anything else. But that being said, though, it is well acted, it is well made, and it is fun. So it's flawed, but it's still a pretty solid episode overall.
Yeah, agreed. And the closing narration for this one. Marsha White, in her normal and natural state, a wooden lady with a painted face who, 1 month out of the year, takes on the characteristics of someone as normal and as flesh and blood as you and I. But it makes you wonder, doesn't it? Just how normal are we? Just who are the people we nod our hellos to as we pass on the street? A rather good question to ask, particularly in the Twilight Zone. Moving on to the next episode for discussion with the dummy.
You give in to some bad hooch and then you have bad nightmares. It's as simple as that. Take away the hooch and you take away the nightmares.
No, you got the chronology wrong, Frank. First the nightmares and then the hooch. I drink because I have to. And I have to because I am. I gotta get rid of it, Frank.
It's a stick of wood? This fugitive from a fireplace? Jerry, how many psychiatrists do you have to see?
And this is from season 3, episode 33. It was directed by Abner Biberman, story by Lee Polk, and written by Rod Serling. It stars Cliff Robertson, Frank Sutton, John Harmon, and Sandra Warner. There are some similarities with Goosebumps' very own dummy, Slappy, and there is a little bit of child's play in there too. The synopsis. Ventriloquist Jerry Etherson is convinced that his dummy, Willy, is alive and evil. He locks Willy in a trunk and makes plans for a new act with a new dummy. Too bad he didn't clear those plans with Willy first. and our opening narration. You're watching a ventriloquist named Jerry Etherson, a voice thrower par excellence, his alter ego sitting atop his lap, is a brash stick of kindling with the sobriquet Willie. In a moment, Mr. Etherson and his knotty pine partner will be booked in one of the out-of-the-way bistros, that small, dark, intimate place known as the Twilight Zone. And Tony, what did you think of The Dummy, as this was your pick for an episode to discuss?
Sobriquet Willie. Well, that's something I can think about right now. With the Dummy, I chose this episode particularly because I absolutely love film, TV shows, and live stages of ventriloquist acts. I've always been fascinated with it. Of course, one of the very first ventriloquist films I've ever seen was Magic, with Anthony Hopkins as well. I believe there was a Tales from the Crypt episode also that had a ventriloquist in it. But then, of course, with but to me, the ultimate ventriloquist film, well, actually, it's part of an anthology series, is from this movie here from 1945 called Dead of Night, with Michael Redgrave playing this ventriloquist. And, oh, boy. That was honestly, to me, the most disturbing ventriloquist story ever. I love it. Even though it's like nearly, it's actually nearly 80 years old. That's but it is really good. If you've ever seen that segment from Dead of Night, it's very disturbing and very, very effective. And yes, I don't know. I just chose that episode because I haven't seen a ventriloquist thing in a while. And then I actually just watched it around 2 hours ago just to refresh myself. And it was a fun episode. I quite enjoyed it. But some of the moments in there were actually quite creepy, especially the voice of Willie, mainly towards the end when he's locked in the trunk. I found that laugh and that very creepy. But then also with the new ventriloquist dummy that Cliff Robertson has as well, I believe his name was Goofy. And it sounds like the main Goofy. And I just thought, okay, well, I can understand why they didn't make it obvious. But, yeah, it had its moments. But knowing that if you think that your dummy is alive, oh, boy. I don't want to think about that. At least it hasn't had at least it hasn't got the psychotic tendencies as Chucky. But it actually has a lot of it actually can give you mental manipulation. Of course, that's what it is. Like, even he was afraid that he might have schizophrenia, if that's what he mentioned in the episode. Is the dummy alive, or is it all in his head? But in the end, we actually do find out, spoiler alert once again, that the dummy is actually alive, or it could be all in his head as well, because you see the dummy move his head, and you also see his mouth move without his human host controlling him. But yes, I chose this episode because I've always been fascinated with ventriloquist acts, and I just thought, yeah, why not? I thought, because I didn't want to go to the obvious popular episodes that were on that list. I wanted to do something that was rarely spoken about or rarely discussed. We'll discuss the same thing, but yeah, that's why I chose this episode. Something different and something that I like personally, as well as my other half. She loves ventriloquist live shows. They're fun to watch as well.
Yeah, definitely. And yes, it's an interesting episode that I enjoyed, and Bede and I also watched this one together, and I'll throw it over to you, Bede.
Indeed. Well, knowing what the episode was about, because I obviously knew that it was going to be a segment that was on the relationship between a man and his ventriloquist dummy, I guess this episode, even though I did enjoy this episode overall, it doesn't really do anything we haven't seen before in other similar stories like Magic, which you brought up, Tony, and also other ones as well. But I think what does make this episode work for me is the performance of Cliff Robertson, who plays Jerry Etherson, who I thought did such a great job with his role. And I think I blew your mind, Marcy, when we were sitting there, because I didn't realize Cliff Robertson was in this episode. And when I told you, and your mouth was just agape, you're like, that's Uncle Ben.
It's like, wait, that's Uncle Ben? Because I had thought, like, I've probably seen Cliff Robertson in stuff and just never put the two and two together. But yeah, I was like, oh, holy shit. And yeah, I agree, like, just excellent in the episode. But continue.
Yeah, I think his performance is what makes the episode, because he's really great in the role of Jerry. But also, he does the voice of Willy and also Goofy Goggles as well. So, and I was kept thinking, like, is he actually doing the voices for the characters, or is that another actor doing it? But it actually is him, and he does such a great job with his vocal performances that you wouldn't think it was him. And also, he manages with his performance to really get us into the mindset of Jerry as he's dealing with Willy. And Willy as a dummy is creepy as fuck. I'm just going to say that right now.
Oh, yeah.
And he is very creepy. And I like the sort of the subtlety that the director Abner Biberman does with the scenes with him. Because you're never quite sure, is it all in Jerry's head? Is Willy actually alive? And it does play that up until the very end, which is, comes to a twist where I'm not sure how it works or how it all happened, but we'll get to that shortly. But yeah, I still think it's a pretty solid episode overall. But I think this is the one where it really is Cliff Robinson's performance that really makes the episode.
Yeah. I agree with a lot of what you both said. Cliff Robertson is great in the episode, and definitely kudos for doing distinct voices for, I guess, Jerry Etherson and Willy and Goofy. So that is just, yeah, that's like pretty cool, I have to say. But yeah, his performance, it takes you down like this mental path where he's questioning his own sanity, but it's also shot really, really well. There's a great one take scene where he's sitting down and you see the mirror and he goes down to get the alcohol, and when he comes back you can see that Willy has moved. It's a really good effective shot, and I noticed there have been similar shots like that through the Twilight Zone, and I think it's really cool, it's really clever, it's well done. And yeah, like you said, Willy is pretty freaking creepy, but I also found a Goofy to be a little creepy, but I kind of find ventriloquist dummies creepy in general, but I do enjoy watching things with ventriloquist dummies. That being said, I enjoy the shenanigans of Slappy from Goosebumps, and we should totally get Slappy versus Willy. I think that would be an interesting
very interesting
ventriloquist dummy versus thing. But yeah, no, I'm glad we watched it, because like you said, it's an episode that you don't really see come up too much in conversation. So yeah, it's good to chat about those ones, but again, like, it's a ventriloquist dummy and they're kind of very creepy. So there is that. As for the ending, where we see Willy is the man and Jerry is the ventriloquist dummy. So is it that Willy was such an asshole he switched their places, or was maybe Jerry a dummy the whole time and it was some weird thing?
It's Twilight Zone, anything can happen, you never know. But
it could be a number of things with the Twilight Zone.
That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how I saw it personally. I think Willy was just an asshole and switched their positions. That's how I'm going to take this one.
Fair enough.
Yeah, well, I think because Willy in this final scene is actually played by a different actor, and it's not Cliff Robinson again. It's a different actor playing him. So I guess in a way, Willy just had enough of being a dummy and he wanted to switch places with Jerry, and that's what happened. I guess that's what the twist is trying to say.
Maybe it's like the really kind of horrific version of Pinocchio.
Maybe. Yeah. It's possible.
It was definitely possible. I don't know. But yeah, look, I think it's quite an enjoyable episode. Definitely recommend it as well. And what was I gonna say? And I don't think it'll change your mind on finding ventriloquist dummies creepy. That's for sure. And Tony, final thoughts and rating out of five.
Well, it was, as I said, it's one that's rarely discussed. It's one that's it's a great episode, but it's not one of the most popular ones, and it's rarely been talked about. So I just thought, what the hell? Just choose something, and it's also something that I like watching on film and live on stage. But for this episode in particular, great moments, especially that Dutch angle battlefield Earth sequence shot, you know, going back. Chase, that was amazing.
That was great.
Yeah, but all in all, I will give this episode 3.5 out of 5 as well. That was really, it's a really entertaining and also very, came quite a disturbing episode as well.
Definitely. And Bede.
Yeah, I give it 3.5 stars that as well. It's still a very solid episode overall, but I do think, again, as I stated before, what really makes this episode work is Cliff Robertson's amazing performances as both our main character of Jerry and, of course, Willie, and also Proxy Goofy as well. So he does a great job in all three parts, and he makes each performance so distinct that you wouldn't think it was from the same actor. And that would explain why he would go on to win an Oscar a couple of years later after this, and well deserved too. So, yeah, it's an enjoyable episode, great filmmaking in it as well. But yeah, it's really Cliff Robertson that makes this one for me. So, 3.5 out of 5.
I think we're all in agreeance again. 3.5. I hope I'm not actually a ventriloquist dummy out of five. Yeah, it's a fun and creepy episode. It definitely gives you what you want out of a Twilight Zone episode, as well as like a really great central performance, and it definitely dives into a little bit of psychological horror as well. So yeah, definitely check it out, people.
Actually, before we move on to our next episode, Marcy, I have to ask you an important question because I feel
Okay.
like this is a we need to talk about this. Since we have just talked about it, episodes that involve a mannequin and involve a ventriloquist dummy, if you had to choose between one or the other, Marcy, which would you rather be?
Oh, maybe the ventriloquist dummy, because I think I would have a bit more movement, and plus I'd probably be about the same height as I'm used to.
And Tony, I'm kind of curious at what yours would be.
I think I'll be a ventriloquist dummy as well because I'm free to say whatever the hell I want and I can get away with it because I'm a dummy.
I would probably be a mannequin mainly because I can just look awesome in clothes and also look very attractive in, as a mannequin. So there you go.
Well, you better hope
Well,
they don't put you in the storeroom.
I hope not because I'll be upset if they did.
Well, at least you won't be alone.
Well, that
Exactly.
is true. That is true.
You'll have many naked mannequins right next to you.
Exactly.
You
Exactly.
might
So.
turn into Maniac from Maniac.
Yes. Yes.
And our closing narration for the dummy. What's known in the parlance of the times as the old switcheroo, from boss to blockhead in a few uneasy lessons. And if you're given to nightclubbing on occasion, check this act. It's called Willie and Jerry, and they generally are booked into some of the clubs along the Grey Night Way, known as the Twilight Zone. I'm not sure I know many nightclubs that have ventriloquist acts, but I think they should start.
Definitely.
Agreed.
And now for something a little different, an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge.
First squad, stand fast. Fall up.
This is from season 5, episode 22. It was directed and written by Robert Enrico, and it is a short film that was aired as an episode of The Twilight Zone. It stars Roger Jacquet and Cornelie Stephane Fay and Jean-Francois Zeller. And I apologize if I mispronounced any of those. The short story that this short film was based on, as well as this short film, I believe potentially inspired Jacob's Ladder, as well as, well, particularly the short story, many, many other things. So there's way too many to mention. The synopsis. During the American Civil War in 1862, a condemned Confederate prisoner, Peyton Farquhar, is due to be hanged by Union troops. The opening narration. Tonight, a presentation so special and unique that for the first time in the 5 years we've been presenting The Twilight Zone, we're offering a film shot in France by others, winner of the Cannes Film Festival of 1962, as well as other international awards. Here is a haunting study of the incredible from the past master of the incredible, Ambrose Bierce. Here is the French production of An Occurrence at Owl Bridge. Beat, you picked this one, so let's get going.
Yeah, well, I think that was one of the main reasons why I picked this episode, was because, unlike all the other episodes that were made for The Twilight Zone, this was the only one that they actually picked up and released as an episode of the show. Because when you kind of look at the history behind the original short film, An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, it's such a fascinating one, because what makes this episode even more interesting compared to the other Twilight Zone episodes is, it's a multi-award winning episode, because it won Best Short Film at the Cannes Film Festival, and it also won the Oscar for Best Short Film as well. So it won all these awards before it even aired on television. And of course, Rod Serling saw it. He loved it so much. And to kind of show it to a wider audience, he made it into an episode of the show. And what's interesting, though, because I watched this episode and I actually managed to track down the short film on its own, and it is on our favorite streaming channel, Tubi, so there you go. And there's no differences whatsoever. I honestly thought when the episode started, I thought, okay, so this is a French short film. Is this episode going to be dubbed over, or is it going to have subtitles? But what I realized pretty quickly is, there's barely any dialogue at all in this episode. And whenever you do hear dialogue, it is spoken in English, but it's very scarcely used. And what's even more interesting is that this episode really kind of focuses on the visuals, the filmmaking, and just visual storytelling more than anything. So you didn't even have to have any dialogue in it whatsoever. But what I think is actually quite incredible about this entire episode is, it's so brilliantly constructed on a filmmaking level. Like, every shot is amazing. And even though I was already aware of the original short story by Ambrose Bierce, because I actually read the short story a long time ago, and it sticks pretty close to the original short story from what I remember. And I think it's just so well constructed, even though I knew what the twist was, but how it's all about the execution for me. And I think it's just so brilliantly executed on a filmmaking level. And even with there is no dialogue whatsoever, the main star, Robert Jacquet, he knows how to emote with his face, and you can just get everything from his performance throughout. And it has great atmosphere. It's beautifully shot. It has a great score in it as well. And also a really weird song that's used through the film, which kind of adds another layer to it as well. And then when the twist actually comes, which I already knew what it was, because this was a twist that inspired so many other stories later on down the track, it still hits you, which is quite amazing. And it just ends the episode on a haunting note. And like, and the only differences between, say, the short film on its own and this episode is, of course, Rod Serling's opening and the little ad break. But even then, since it is a short film, they didn't cut out anything. And also Rod Serling's last narration. That's the only things that they added. Like, it is the complete episode. I mean, it is the complete short film that they put together for this episode. And I just think it's brilliant. I can definitely see why this short film has been considered by many as one of the greatest short films ever made. It is just so brilliant in every way.
Tony, what are your thoughts on an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge?
I never thought I would say the words Academy Award winning and Palme d'Or winning short film in a Twilight Zone episode. It certainly was fantastic. And as you said, Beat, the performance says it all. Like, and as you said, the emotion, how he emotes his face in the episode, damn, that was good. But yeah, the way the episode was shot, and also the way it was constructed, I just thought it was incredible. Definitely great choice, I have to say. But yeah, as you said, with the ending, the twist ending, it just hits you like that. You just didn't expect that. But because I haven't read the short story or seen the original film, so I didn't know anything about it. And mind you, I have seen it before because I've got the Twilight Zone box set, and I've seen it ages ago. But watching it again recently in preparation for this, it was good to watch it again with fresher perspective. Mm. And it was great. It was a really good episode, I gotta say.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Yeah, like the awards that it won, very well deserved. And I do think that it's really cool that Rod Serling was like, yeah, let's show this on the Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I was actually a little bit shocked with some of the visuals that were there, and they were actually kept in. As you said, Bede, it's no different than the short film, just for the narration and stuff. And that seemed very, what's the right word? A little shocking for something like the Twilight Zone. But I also think that seeing it in that context, it hits harder as well. But yeah, that main performance is incredible. And there is so much to be said just within a face and actions. And it is very much in this art kind of style. And I would not be surprised if this was something that David Lynch really loved, because you can kind of see, of course, Lynchian in this, or something that he may have seen and incorporated. Or
absolutely,
it's definitely very, it's tragically beautiful, I would say. And yeah, there is not a lot of dialogue, so when it's there, I don't think you really even need it.
No. Not at all,
yeah. And it's interesting with the setting of the American Civil War, with a condemned prisoner who we don't really know what happened, I guess, just being caught or something, I don't know. But he gets hung, and as you see, he goes into the water and he manages to escape, and he keeps managing to escape the Union troops and tries to find his way back home. And when he eventually gets there, you realize it was just his last thoughts, as he actually did get hung. And the ending did take me by surprise, because I wasn't familiar with the story. I haven't read the story or had seen the short film. I don't think I'd even actually heard of it until this. So yeah, I definitely wasn't aware of the ending, but I did immediately think of Jacob's Ladder, because there is that war contrast as well, which, yeah, I thought was interesting. But yeah, it's an incredible short film. And definitely, like, I really encourage people to check out short films, whether they're newer ones, older ones. There are definitely some gems in there to be found, and I'm sure you definitely both agree with that.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, definitely. Like, I think what's interesting about this, I mean, about, I guess, not just this episode, but the original short story is, I guess, compared, because we have talked about on previous episodes on The Twilight Zone, Marcy, how some of these episodes may have inspired other films down the track or been inspiration for a lot of films. But I think what's interesting is that the original short story probably is the big, has been the biggest inspiration on all different aspects of media, because you have, like you said, you have mentioned Jacob's Ladder, and there's so many other movies that have had similar twists in it. And spoilers for those who don't want to hear some of these, like Brazil is another one. Also, like films like, well, Jacob's Ladder, as you mentioned before, but also Carnival of Souls is another one as well. And yeah, there's just a lot of them. There's a lot of films and stories out there that have very similar twists to this one. And in a way, you could say that the original short story was the forefront to that type of twist. Like, again, it may have been the earliest story to have that sort of twist. So I guess, I mean, granted, this episode itself may have definitely inspired a lot of things, but I think the short story itself that it's based on is probably the most influential out of, I guess, any of the episodes that we have talked about for this show from The Twilight Zone.
Yeah, definitely very possible. Like, the short story, now I'm very curious to read it, has inspired a lot of things, and that does make a lot of sense. And while it may be sort of a twist that has been done a lot, it is very effective because of how everything else unfolds with this short. So I definitely appreciate that.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I think the filmmaking also really helps too, because I think it's just so brilliantly constructed on a filmmaking level. And like you say, Marcy, this is definitely, I mean, I can't say this is the best filmmaking that we've seen on an episode of The Twilight Zone, because technically it wasn't made for The Twilight Zone, but I think even then, it's like the filmmaking, if this is just so incredible, every shot is just amazing. Like, it's just well constructed on that front.
Yeah, it's done very beautifully. There's some really memorable shots. There's some haunting shots in there as well.
Oh yeah,
definitely.
I was gonna say, it was, to me, the most haunting shot, you see it repeatedly, is when you see the woman coming out of coming out of the house, but you see the same thing but in different angles over and over. I thought, okay, then you can see something's not right. But then that I thought was effective personally.
I thought so as well. And even just because I did notice when he was coming towards her, they just reused the same shot of that a whole bunch of times. And I think, I don't know what the director, Robert Enrico's intention was for that, but I would imagine it was more like an early indicator to the audience, like, something's not right here.
Oh, definitely, because it happens quickly, but it leaves you feeling uneasy, and you're sort of like, well, why is it taking so long for them to reconnect? Or, but then, you know, you obviously find out. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting one, because it was a short film and not made and written for The Twilight Zone. But again, it's very cool that it was shown as an episode of The Twilight Zone for more people to see. And it's also great that they didn't cut anything, so you actually got the full experience with the episode.
And just sort of to add on that, Marcy, I'll read this bit of trivia on the episode that I found on this episode's trivia page on IMDb. Rod Serling was getting ready to take his end of season break, but all with one of the shows for the fifth season already filmed or in production, Weedy decided to leave early and go to a French film festival. That is where he saw an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge and immediately hunted down the producers with an offer to buy it for a one-time showing for American TV. Serling reportedly picked it up for $20,000 and flew straight back to Los Angeles, filming a new intro the moment he got to the studio and plugging the show into the same week's time slot. Not only did Serling get what he considered a classic, he also saved nearly $100,000 in production costs and brought the season's worth of shows in on budget as well.
So not only did he absolutely love what he saw, but he managed to save a few thousand dollars on production costs. Very clever, Mr. Serling.
Yeah, but I do like the idea that it's essentially he just found this short film and was like, oh, like obviously, like he would have been blown away by it, and also may have, you know, having a twist in there as well would have definitely have sealed the deal for him as well. But it kind of makes me think, because I know the fifth season was the last season of the Twilight Zone, so it makes me think like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if like maybe the sixth season like would have been episodes that Serling and others went out into the world and found all these different short films that definitely have a Twilight Zone feel to them, and just showed them throughout, I guess, another season of the show. Because you could easily have done that.
Maybe in an alternate reality that happened.
Definitely.
In the Twilight Zone.
Yes.
And Bede, your final thoughts and rating out of 5.
Oh, I'm giving this 5 stars, Marcy. I think this is an incredible short film / episode of the show. I think it's just haunting. Like, the whole episode is just completely haunting. Even though, yes, I already knew what the twist was, but I think it still manages to get you. And I think on a filmmaking level, it's just so beautifully handled. And the performance of the main star is great, even though he never utters a single word throughout it. But it's just a beautiful, haunting episode of the show, and like I said, I can definitely see why not only this episode but also the short film is considered like one of the great short films ever made.
Yes. And Tony?
Yes, I agree with you, Bede, regarding how he is definitely seen as one of the greatest shorts of all time. But I love, as you said, the execution of the film, the way it was shot, brilliant. It was fantastic. And it's definitely one of the most unusual Twilight Zone episodes, because it's not what you would expect, and it turned out to be fantastic. But my score for this episode is four out of five, because it was certainly something I wasn't expecting. But then when the ending came, really hit you. But yeah, I loved it. But yeah, to me, it is a 4 out of 5 episode. I really enjoyed it.
And for me, I'm right in the middle at 4.5. I hope I'm not dead and just living all these moments out of my head out of 5. It really is something very different. It's really well done. It definitely throws you for a bit of a loop. And again, it has such a great, I don't want to say execution, because it literally has an execution of the ending with the twist. But yeah, just a really beautifully and well done short film. And again, very worthy of all the awards, very worthy of being shown as a Twilight Zone episode, and absolutely recommend this one. And the closing narration. An occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge in two forms, as it was dreamed and as it was lived and died. This is the stuff of fantasy, the thread of imagination, the ingredients of the Twilight Zone. And with that, that brings our episode to an end. You can find Podcasters of Horror at supermarcy.com, which is the home of the Super Network, where Podcasters of Horror is posted, as well as following, subscribing, liking, sharing, all that stuff from most or all of the podcast streaming platforms, Spotify, Apple, all of those. And of course, you can find the Super Network on all your socials and keep up to date with what's coming up or what's out with our episodes. And me personally, I am Super Marcy on all the socials. I am Super_Marcy on Letterboxd, and you can see the weird and wonderful things I watch on the regular. And I'll also plug After Dark with Super Marcy podcast. And again, just find that on your podcast streaming players. Bede.
Well, people want to find me personally, you can find me out there on social media, on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under Bede Jabide. You can also find all my work over at supermarcy.com, and you can follow my solo podcast, Bead vs. the Living Dead, and as well as its spin-off show, Bead and Steve vs. Care Crystal Lake, on all podcast streamers everywhere via the Bead vs. the Living Dead podcast feed or the Bead and Steve vs. Care Crystal Lake podcast feed.
Awesome. And Tony, what about for you?
You can follow me on Letterboxd under FilmNut79. I'm also on Instagram under FilmNut79. And of course, you can follow me on Facebook from the Imprint Films Blu-ray Collections fan group and Imprint Cast Facebook pages. And you can listen to Imprint Cast on Spotify, Amazon Music, and iTunes and Google, with more to come, as well as Indicator Cast as well, which I frequently collaborate with my partner, John Matthews, as well. So feel free to, if you want to discuss film, feel free to add me and we'll discuss more films and everything else.
Yes, highly recommend people check out both Imprint Cast and Indicator Cast. And you might find Bede and I guesting on some of those shows on occasion, because we love to collaborate with our good friends. And check out the Imprint Collectors fan group page. That's always a lot of fun and always good to see what's coming up from Imprint or just talk about the stuff in collection. So, yeah, very cool. And thank you so much, everybody. And until next time, we will see you in the Twilight Zone, because I said so. Good night.
Have a good night. Thank you.
Do, 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 do.